Hello?
Log Talk Radio.
And I'd like to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio, as I was talking on mute, so that's just crazy. But I would like to welcome my special guest tonight, David Ford, to the show. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing pretty good. It's getting cold here. It's our November the 15th show, and it's hard to believe that it's already mid-November, but here we are. And we want to start off tonight, David, talking about the current lineup of Bubble Puppy and what you guys are doing right now. I know you've got shows lined up. Talk about some of the projects and shows. Is there any recording, any albums in the future? What's going on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we've done a really good job of recreating the feel of Bubble Puppy as far as the... You know, Bubble Puppy was always about being a band of brothers and being a family. I mean, we actually all lived together the entire time we were together. But we haven't quite gotten to the part where we're just writing a lot of songs yet. I mean, I think we're getting there, but we're not quite there yet. So this town is full of studios, so the second we do have something, we'll be in the studio. But I think that's really, and I try to get this across to the band members that, we really have to do, even though we were famous at one time, we have to get back in the studio and have new product and get airplay just like every other band does and get people excited about being on our team, you know, with airplay and record sales and promotions. And that's the way things get, that's the way the ball gets rolling in the music business, is new product.
Exactly. And you made some great points that we could talk about for a while, but let's talk about the I know you have a show coming up in Houston. What other things are coming up for Bubble Puppy?
Well, we have this Austin Psychedelic Fest in December, and then we're playing back here in at the 1-to-1 bar. And so we're averaging about once a month, which is pretty good considering everybody is super busy, and it's amazing that we have time to find time to rehearse and be as tight as we are, which we are. Did you get a chance to look at any of the video of us at the Roost?
Yeah,
recently?
I did. Yeah, that was very impressive.
That was a good show. Good
yeah.
Show.
How did that feel getting back with, you know, Rod and just, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day about, you know, like I'm from that era, the 60s and 70s, and I can remember, David, when it was so amazing to be able, like if you were in an area and you just drop in into a bar or a club or something, and you would hear this amazing music. You would hear music that would just blow your mind, and I'm not... I know I'm older now and all that, but I don't know if that's still happening today with the younger music. But back then, it was something magical. You could hear all these incredible bands, and you know what I mean? It was such a great feeling back then.
Oh, I used to go to we used to play at a club in Houston. We lived in Houston for a while, and there's a club there. It's kind of a famous club. It's called the Love Street Light Circus and Feel Good Machine. Love Street.
Yeah, I love
but
that.
We might have talked about this, but the center section of the audience laid down.
Yeah.
It had pillows and headboards.
Yeah, that's
and, but I used to go there when we weren't playing there. We played there a lot. I used to go there and just hear Sheba's Headband, Johnny Winters, The Conqueror, just all these incredible 60s bands, Moving Sidewalks, you know, Billy Gibbons. Just, I mean, any given night, you could go down there and just hear some, you know, Lightning Hopkins or just some incredible talent on any night down there. So I know what you mean about going into a club and getting your mind blown.
Yeah, and I thought
great.
It was – yeah, and I just know that – well, I was going to bring this up because there was this show on HBO right now, and the Foo Fighters have – put this show out. It's a documentary on rock music, and they have this whole thing on Austin, and the you know the Austin feel of the town and the all the bands that were there and all you know all that went on in the 60s and 70s and things like that. And you know, I was just kind of thinking, you know, I wasn't in that area, but it was an amazing time. You know, sometimes I feel, you know, David, really old, and I think, oh, my gosh, I'm so old. I'm like ancient. I'm talking to these guys about music that are just starting out. You know, I'll talk to bands that are under, you know, 17 years old, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, you know. And then I think about it, you know, I really feel so fortunate to be able to look back and to be alive during that time, because that was such an amazing time of music. Now, with Bubble Puppy now, when you guys – do you feel any of that? Because that's what I think needs to be happening now in the music industry, is that feel of that we had back in those days.
Yeah, I don't know if young bands are capturing that feel, but there are so many good bands, good young bands. I listen to Spotify, so I can listen to whatever I want. This is how I research new music. There's a great station here called KUTX. It's the public radio station here. They have a news channel and a music channel, and they play some great stuff. For a while there they weren't, but now they're playing cutting edge stuff. And so I have an app on my phone. If I hear a sound alike, I capture it on that app, and it tells me what song it is, and I can listen to it on Spotify.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And every time I hear a good band, I go, wow, that's a great band. And I look them up, and they're friggin' from Austin.
Yeah.
There's so many good bands here.
Yeah. That's the thing that, you know, everybody talks about that. And a lot of bands, you know, people will – well, most of the time they're either going to Nashville or Austin It's one of those two places. You know, when I talk to people, it's like, well, you know, I want to make it, so I'm going. And I guess, you know, I've never been to Nashville. I've been to Memphis. I love Memphis, but I've never been to Nashville. And I know that people say there's more than country music there. But one thing I think is cool about Austin, and I want your opinion on this, is that, you know, like Jimmy Dale Gilmore, you have so many different types of music that all kind of play together. You have the punk scene, you have the rock scene, you have blues, you have jazz, you have everything in that city and clubs to support all that. Some towns, David, have a hard time doing that because, like, you know, I'm from Columbus, and Columbus, the only reason it has a music scene is because of the university, you know, Ohio State University, with the 50,000, 60,000 kids there. And they, you know, they fill up the music venues. And you can hear all kinds of music, but I was just wondering, why do you think it is in Austin that it's so, that the music is so diverse, where you can hear so many different types of music there?
Wow, big question. I think that it's like a steamroller, like a snowball. I think originally, you probably don't know this, like, this is one of the most expensive places to live now, but it used to be, it was one of the cheapest places to live, like in the 60s. I mean, I paid $100 a month. I think $90 a month for a three-bedroom house. And, you know, Rod lived with me for a while. But it was so cheap that, I mean, there was so many musicians moving here to just take advantage of the lifestyle. We had the lakes, you know, a whole bunch of really nice lakes, although they're dry right now. And it was just really a beautiful time here in Austin in the 60s. I had a Triumph motorcycle, and I used to ride around all over town. And
oh, wow.
It was just a joke. We lived in the country in our own private canyon. And it was just a beautiful, idyllic place. So I think that drew a lot of people here, and a lot of great bands came. You know, the Elevators were playing at the same time we were. And I think that drew a lot of people here, and it just kept going. That, and then finally, when it did get more expensive, it had such a solid foundation of clubs and musicians that it just kept going. I mean, it's pretty darn expensive for a band to live here now. It's not, they don't come here because it's cheap anymore. It's expensive. But I think it just started out in the 60s and just snowballed now, and this is a place to be with South by Southwest. You know, every year, it's just a place to be. So that's why there's so many good bands here.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point. I think, you know, I kind of go back because that documentary I was telling you about, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's really good. You know, they interview Rocky Erickson, and, you know, you're talking about the Elevators, 13th floor Elevators. And that was also kind of an interesting thing to me because I know we're just kind of talking music here, but although, you know, they kind of put them in the psychedelic music scene, but they were different. I mean, didn't they have like an electric jug player or something?
Oh, they were. That's what Dave Grohl was. You were talking about the Foo Fighters documentary.
Yeah.
Well,
I saw
that the other day, and one of the things that he said that Dave Grohl said he didn't realize that the psychedelic music scene started here in Austin. He thought it started in San Francisco until he got here and started talking about Rocky and the Elevators, and it started here. The 13th floor Elevators, believe me, I saw them several times. They were about as psychedelic as you can get when nobody else was. I saw them at the Dunes in Port Aransas. I saw them at the Stardust Roller Rink in Corpus Christi. I saw them in all sorts of states of mind, too. And they were fantastic live. The original band was fantastic.
Yeah, and it was funny, you know, when you're right, it was Dave talking to Rocky, and he was going back in that time and that era. But I just think it was such an amazing time because, like, I talked to my kids about that. You know, we would, back in those days, we could go into a bar and hear Bob Seger. Bob Seger used to play all the time around here, and the James Gang, and Alice Cooper, and all of these different bands, and that you would just hear them in a club. And, you know, Glass Harp and these different groups. And I think, I would imagine, David, it's happening now, but it's just, maybe it's because it's happened before that it doesn't seem so amazing to me. Does that make sense?
Don't forget that rock and roll exists because each generation feels like they discovered it.
Yeah.
Like my niece came up to me one time. She goes, "Man, have you heard this guitar player called Jimi Hendrix?" Yeah, I think I heard him. But she felt like she discovered it, and that's why the whole industry exists, because you know, when you're young and you discover something like you were talking about, it's tremendously exciting. Not quite as exciting now, but boy, it was back then.
Yeah, that's when I just sometimes I'll sit down and it's like, you know, I'm the old guy telling the stories, and I feel like, oh wow.
Yeah.
But what are some of the stories that, I mean, not only did I heard a lot of great bands, but you were in a lot of great bands and played a lot of great music. When you, and right now you're playing, how do you compare that time with, you know, with like playing with the musicians and doing a lot of things that were new and fresh, and now, you know, more mature and probably, I don't know if there's as many obstacles then as there is now or vice versa, but how do you compare that, being a musician now and a musician back then?
Well, there's still the thing of I love to play. It does something for me. Like we were playing a whole lot, but then we've had 2 or 3 weeks off here, all my bands, and I just don't feel right. I need to get out there and play. We're going to play tonight.
No, that's good.
That's one thing. But, when I was 17, I was focused. I was sure, there was no doubt in my mind what I wanted to be, a rock and roll drummer, and I wanted to do it with Bubble Puppy, period. And
yeah.
So that my entire life was geared for that. And it was fun. I mean, you go play a gig, and the crowd was pretty good, and they were into it. I mean, there was nothing better in my life than that. I mean, now it's still a lot of fun, but it's and it's pretty much the best thing in my life still. It's great, but it's a little more work now, and it's a little harder, you know, pulling the whole thing off, which is amazing when you think about the five amazing players we have in our band, all making time in their schedules for Bubble Puppy.
Yeah, and just for you brought it up there, David, a little bit, that people, you can go out on YouTube and see some of their current shows that they've had, and they're just amazing. And I think that's, you know, a really good media for people to see, because not everybody can go to the shows. So it's a good idea, you know, go out on YouTube and check them out. And also, David has a website, davidfore.com. And I'd like to talk about, well, I know that you're in other bands, and one thing, I don't think we talked about this before, David, but you can tell me if we did, but you're in the Eggmen, which is a Beatles tribute band, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah, we're playing tonight.
Now, tell me, I'm curious about that. I've heard a lot of, and I'm a total Beatles freak, there's just no, to me, that's just it, but it starts and stops there, but then, you know, that's just how I am, but when you're playing the drums for the Beatles, how do you approach that when you play with the Eggmen and the Beatles music, and then you're also playing with Bubble Puppy? When you're playing, do you try to capture the way Ringo Starr played, or you're playing it the way David Foer plays it?
No, of course I try to play it the way Ringo played it. And I get mad at other drummers when I see them playing Ringo songs and they don't do that. Like, that's kind of one reason I'm not real wild about Paul McCartney's current band, because the drummer, Abe Laboriel, he just kind of, once in a while, he plays Ringo's parts. Just kind of, I mean, everyone else in the band has to play their parts exactly, but he just kind of, he does give a little homage to Ringo, but he kind of, I don't really enjoy his playing very much. But, thing about the Eggmen is you couldn't find a Beatles band that looks less like the Beatles. But we're incredibly authentic in the fact that we have we play whatever guitar they played, we stop and we change guitars. We play the exact guitars they do.
Wow.
And if you go around and listen to, there's a Beatles tribute band in every town, which means you really can't tour. But if you go listen to the other Beatles, we sound better than 95% of the other Beatles bands I've ever heard. I mean, it's really, the vocals are fantastic. And, you know, when you're talking about how I feel when I'm playing those songs. Well, I just look down at the set list and I go, oh my God, I can't believe I'm getting to play these songs. There's not a bad song in the bunch. Whereas an original band, you know, sometimes I love this song, but I'm not too wild about this song. I love this song. But in the Eggman, I look down there and I love every song we play.
Now, I know you guys played from like the beginning of the Beatles' career to the end. So, and Ringo, did he change as the band progressed in his playing, or was it pretty much the same from the early records to the later records?
That's a good question. The sound of his drums certainly changed in the 70s. I don't know if you remember, but like with the Eagles, the sound of the snare drum changed. It used to be kind of a live sound with a kind of rang. But then all of a sudden they just start putting towels all over the drums. And it sounds real dead, like on Come Together, that tom-tom sound on Come Together.
Right.
Dun, 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 dun. It's got, obviously it has like towels over the tom-toms. So the sound of his drums changed. But I don't know, I thought he was fantastic from start to finish. He doesn't get nearly enough credit but every drummer in America plays a Ringo lick, whether they know it or not. I mean, anytime you hear ba-dum bum, ba-da-da-da-dum, that's Ringo, right?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's great. That's a great insight, because I wouldn't have known that. Now, I have another question for you on that line, and I don't think we talked about this before, but okay, so I went to see Pete Best play at a small theater, and my wife and I went, and we were right close to him. I mean, actually, I've seen Ringo play a couple of times, so I was very close to him. We could see, you know, him playing. But, you know, the big thing with Pete Best playing, and I hear other musicians talk about it, you know, he just wasn't at the level with the Beatles, and I get that. I understand that. But when I'm not a drummer, so when I, you know, went there, I want to hear his band, you know, I want to hear a Beatle, I want to got a chance to talk to him a little bit. So when I'm watching him play, David, from a non-drummer perspective, he looked pretty good to me. I mean, he's in his 70s, but he was playing right along. I mean, nothing real super fancy. His brother Rogue plays with him. So what as a drummer, from a technical perspective, what is it that was so much, I know Ringo's a better drummer, but what was it that was different between the two of them that Paul and John, and they were thinking, okay, nice guy, Pete, everything's cool, but we need to you know, go to another level. What would you say is the difference? I was always curious about that.
Yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with technical ability. There's a million good musicians in the world. It's just a Ringo fit. He was one of the guys, you know, they probably, I don't think he just wasn't one of the guys. And when Ringo came along, they just hit it off. He'd played with him before. He'd sat in with him before they asked him to join. So they knew he fit in. And you know, it's a lot of time in a band, it's like, does this guy fit in? You know, he has to fit in. It's more important than if he's good technically. And I think Ringo fit in much better than Pete did. That's my personal opinion.
Well, yeah, that's a good insight, because I was just curious, because actually, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but some of the interviews with Pete Best, and where they talk to him about how he was in the Beatles and now he isn't, he looks so sad. it's like, you know, you had every lottery number but one, and you just missed it. That's the look he has, you know. It's like,
that's got to hurt.
Yeah, and I always thought, man, you know, and I really enjoyed the show that they played, but I was always thinking about that, you know. What is it from a tech, what were they looking for in Ringo that they didn't see in Pete? But yet you made some great points. My guess is,
well,
David,
you know, George Martin had two other session drummers sitting out in the studio when Ringo first joined the band, because he didn't think Ringo was good enough.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, you know, Love Me Do. There's three versions of Love Me Do floating around. One is with Alan White, I think it is, and another drummer, and then Ringo's drummer. And I actually, somebody put up a YouTube video of all three versions right next to each other, and Ringo's is the best. So he's the one that's on the single, I believe, of Love Me Do.
Yeah, that's I have to check that out. That sounds pretty cool. I love that guy.
Yeah, you can actually hear. That's the version I play is the version he played. But George Martin didn't see. See, George Martin probably was thinking from a technical perspective, well, this guy is not the, you know, the best drummer in the world, but the band was saying, well, yeah, but this is our guy, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it was a team thing. And also, when I think it's really interesting while we're talking about the Beatles a little bit, was when, you know, Ringo, in one of the interviews that I heard, towards the end there, he didn't feel like he fit in. He felt like they were so good, and he was kind of like this guy that just didn't fit in, and he was going to quit the band. Did you ever hear that?
Well, you know that John and Paul ran the band. It was their band, right? It wasn't George's band or Ringo's band, so I could see how he could feel that way. And they could be assholes, too, you know, like they... there's some pretty famous stories of them, you know, just grinding the rest of the band on the ground. But and you know, the people in my in the Eggman, they know. I don't really know that much about the Beatles, but they do. They know everything. It's just amazing. Anytime I have a question, they can answer it. But I think Paul, once Paul and it's good to have. Paul and John had that block, right? They ran the band, and that was good. It was they steered the ship that was the Beatles, right? Once they stopped getting along, it must have been really tough because all of a sudden the leadership was fragmented. And Paul tried to run the band at the end there, which that must have been really hell for Ringo. Because Paul would, you know, just play drums, right, whenever he felt like it.
Yeah, well,
he wouldn't even call Ringo. He just, you know, he played drums on Back in the USSR, and he didn't even ask Ringo, right?
Yeah, isn't that incredible? Because what do you think of Paul McCartney's drumming? Because I was talking to some people just recently in an interview about this, about Paul's. Well, it was actually Rick Ramadka, who's a really great musician in Los Angeles, and he played in his latest album. He played all the instruments. He's not a drummer, but you know, he played drums. What do you think of that? Non-drummers playing drums.
Paul's a good. He's a good guitar player. He's great. The best bass player. He's a good drummer. You know, he's not as original as Ringo, but he's certainly good. I mean, I didn't even know that wasn't him, that wasn't Ringo for a long time.
Yeah, I didn't either till now.
The drum parts in Bubble Puppy. It's kind of like I had to go back and learn those parts from some other drummer. Right, I thought I knew him, but I started listening to him.
From you, and you're the other drummer.
I'm the other drummer. I was going, what was I thinking? That's hard. That's fast.
Oh, that's amazing.
The 17-year-old me and the 64-year-old me. The 64-year-old me trying to imitate the 17-year-old me is pretty funny.
Oh, that's pretty cool. But when you look back at that and you listen to yourself and you're thinking, how much of that do you think, David, was just your born talent, and how much of that do you think it was that hard work you put into it in the practice?
Well, I was connected to Bull Puppy. I mean, Rod and I were connected at the hip, and I always played my snare drum with his rhythm guitar, and then I played my bass drum foot with Roy's bass. I mean, Roy and I would go to the Vulcan and just practice the whole entire set, just he and I, bass and drums. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, I love that.
That's how dedicated we were. And we practiced, you know, all the time, every night sometimes, if we weren't playing. And the band pretty much developed my drumming because I was just a kid, you know. I quit high school and went up and joined the band, and we started playing and coming up with all this, you know, totally original music. I think I told you we only had three records. We had, like, Steppenwolf, Wheels of Fire, and the Youngbloods album, and that was it. And we live in the country, no radio or anything. So we were pretty darn original because we didn't have any influences really, except for there's a little bit of country, oddly enough, in the early Bull Puppy, just because we lived in Texas, I think.
Yeah, that would have a some influence on you. It was funny because I had my car back in those days. I had an 8-track player, and all I had was Woodstock and Three Dog Night. And that's
nice.
All I have.
That's funny. Yeah. The kids nowadays have access to everything.
Yeah, and
that
I used to think
exists.
All excited about music, but I only had two, or eight tracks. So
that's
like,
pretty funny.
Oh,
I have a Bell Puppy. I have a Bell Puppy 8-track.
Oh man, that's amazing! Isn't there an 8-track museum?
Oh really? I don't
yeah.
know. It should be.
I'll send you that information. There's a.
You should.
There's
I should probably donate my 8-track to the museum.
Oh, he would love it. He's in Texas too. And I'll send that information to you. And it's awesome. But
well, you know, 8-tracks are real high quality. They have it's a big tape moving at a high speed, which is what gives you good quality.
Yeah.
Like later on, cassettes, they were much smaller tape and moved much less fast. So 8-tracks are actually really good quality.
And we used to have some pretty loud. You get the speakers in your doors of the car. I had a Volkswagen, and you'd open that up and crank up your 8-track, and it was cool. It was awesome. Back in the day.
Oh, tell me more, John. Tell me more.
Back in the days. My guess
oh,
is
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, let's play a song. You sent me some really good stuff from Demian, and it's just for the listeners out there, the people. Bubble Puppy... You guys, the same people, right? You were having. And correct me if I'm wrong. You went to California, had a little trouble with your record label, and you picked up a new manager. Was that Nick? I think from
from Steppenwolf.
And changed your name to Demian. Now, am I saying that right?
We always say Damien.
Okay.
It's the name of a book, so. Who knows how that's pronounced?
Damien sounds like.
But we always say Damien, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's your band, so I'll go along with that. So with Damien, when you guys went out there and you started, you know, and I'll tell you, you know, listening to the songs, it's just so incredible. It makes me also think about back in those days when I'd walk into a place and hear music, you know, that was just so wide open. And so, you know, it was like the... You've got the dueling guitars, you know, the harmonizing guitar work there, and which is so just really amazing to me. So did you guys, if you wouldn't have changed the name, do you think there would have been any change in the band, David, or do you think it would have pretty much been the same? Can you tell the difference between the Bubble Puppy stuff and the Damien stuff?
Oh, yeah, there's a world of difference, I think. The Bell Puppy stuff. See, here's what people always say. We decided to move out of Houston because the record company International Artists was a joke, and so there was some talk of moving to San Francisco, which is where, you know, the elevators lived, right? The Rocky and the elevators lived in Austin, and they decided to move to San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
And so I don't know. Maybe if we'd have moved to San Francisco, we'd have had a more psychedelic sound. But when we moved to L.A., that was a rock town, you know, back then. Period. Right.
Right.
So I don't know if we were heading that way anyway. It's hard to say, but we were probably heading that way anyway. But we became more of a rock band, as opposed to a, you know, whatever Bell Puppy was. There was, of course, still elements of the original Bell Puppy, but we started rocking. Like in that album, can I tell you an interesting anecdote about that album, the Damien
sure.
album?
Yeah.
Okay, so we moved to L.A. and within a few weeks had a record deal with ABC Dunhill. I don't know if you remember them.
Yeah.
But
oh,
and
yeah.
Bill Zimzik from the Eagles produced our. He was the Eagles producer, and James Gang. But he produced our demo that got us our deal. So he was going to record us at the Electric Ladyland in L.A.
Okay.
But our manager screwed up. It soured the deal. But anyway, so he wound up producing. Our manager, Nick, wound up producing the album. But the only time we could get at Electric Ladyland was from 12 at night till 6 in the morning.
Okay.
So that album that you heard, the Damien album,
yep.
That we started recording at midnight. God, think about that. But that would just kill me now. But back then, it was just, well, that's what we got to do, right?
And that, yeah, and just that, yeah. So did that, I'm just trying to, sometimes what I do, David, is try to go back to that and try to think how that was because, well, you know, that's the time you have, that's the time you got to do. So were you geeked up? I mean, was that adrenaline or were you, because I would think you would be tired. Would that affect any of your playing or it didn't?
Well, it did because not only, remember I told you that during this, that was like 1970, and that's when that dead drum sound, like disco drums kind of,
Okay.
that's when that started. So the Electric Ladyland, they had a drum booth that was padded with carpeted on all the walls, and over the top of the drum booth, they had a silk parachute. So it was, and you know, the engineer came out there and taped a wallet to my snare drum. So the freaking drums were as dead as a doornail. So you know, that makes it harder to play, right? And plus, there's no echo off the walls because they were all padded. Plus, it was midnight. I mean, it was a freaking struggle to for me on that album. I didn't really enjoy recording that album as much as the Bo Puppy album for me. And I don't think everybody had the same experience, but it was kind of a struggle for me. But man, the Bo Puppy album, that was fun from start to finish. I mean, that couldn't have been any more fun recording that album. So it's kind of a contrast.
So, what made that album so much fun?
Oh man, this is when we were just, you know, like we started recording the record. You know, we were still kind of struggling. We were just going to, you know, living together in a small apartment, and we had the dream, and we were coming up with songs like every day and going in there and recording them. And it
Yeah.
was very, you know, if we wanted to record, we'd just call them up and say, hey, we'll record, and we'd just go over there and record. And our engineer was a lot of fun. The producer was great. It was a very lighthearted kind of feel. You know, most stuff we got in two or three takes. I think there was one take 28, but for the most part, like Hot Smoke was probably two or three takes. So
Wow.
we were just, you know, blowing through the material recording. So it was a breeze, right? And I could, you know, we'd record in the afternoon or early evening, not starting at midnight. That was ridiculous, especially for me. I mean, people like Todd Potter, man, Todd just shredded. Our guitar player Damien Bo Puppy, he just shredded on the Damien album. That's some of the best guitar work I've ever heard. So he wouldn't have the same experience I was.
Oh, that's wild. So, you know, just for people that have never, you know, recorded in a studio, and that would be me and everyone else that's listening that hasn't, what's it like? I mean, you have to go in, you're laying down individual tracks. How does that, just go through that process with us.
Well, we didn't do that so much in Bo Puppy because, you know, we over the I mean, rapidly from the time we were started recording in Bo Puppy to the time we finished recording in Damien, technology changed radically. So we started out, I can never remember, I think we only had four tracks in Bo Puppy. We might have had eight, but that's what the Beatles had. They had four tracks. They would come in and record on three tracks, and a team would come in later and bounce it all down to one track. That's why everything sounds so funny in the Beatles, early Beatles. You know, everything's on one side, like all the drums and bass, everything on one side, and there'll be one thing over on the left side. That's because they had no tracks.
Oh, wow.
So we would always record bass and drums together, at least, if not a rhythm guitar. So we never did tracking in the Bo Puppy, not like you do now, where you just play just the drums, right? And then you had just the bass, and you had just the guitar. We always played together, which is a lot more fun, believe me, because you're under
Yeah.
a microscope, right? And it's
Yeah, I
nice to
was
have
just
some other guys there with you under the microscope.
Yeah, I was just wondering how that goes. I've never done that. So to me, it's like, so what are you listening to in your headset when you're drumming it?
Well, I would have, you know, in Bone Puppy, I would have Roy and then Rod playing guitar maybe, and then somebody singing a scratch vocal because, you know, whoever was playing the bass or guitar, they couldn't concentrate on the vocals, obviously. But you kind of need somebody to sing so you know where you are in the song, right? You don't want to get lost. So somebody would just kind of mumble the words while they were playing. But that is great compared to just going in there and playing it by yourself on the drums, which is what. And Damien, let's see, I can't remember what we did in Damien. I think probably Roy and I would play it together, maybe even Rod, but we wouldn't keep any of that. That's the difference. Bull puppy, Roy and Rod would play with me. We'd keep it. Damien, they would just throw away everything else, and then the bass would come back in and play it again, just so you can make everything perfect.
Oh.
Boy, you can really lose a lot of spontaneity that way if you're not careful.
Yeah, that's a great insight. I really didn't know that. I've always wondered how that works, because I think I would be a little nervous if I had to just sit down and play my piece all by myself, and without depending on everybody else around me to kind of, back me up and help me if I made a mistake and things like that. But
nowadays, if I've just come to the realization recently, I have a home studio, and I've been investigating a lot of techniques for, but nowadays, not so much with the independent bands, but man, there's nobody that's even playing the drums anymore. They have these programs, like drumming programs,
right?
That you actually have a set of drums and you can modify it in the software, and I don't think there's anybody playing. I would say half the records you hear out there now, that's not a real drummer. It's a program. They're that good, and you can't tell.
Even though you can't tell, can you tell as being a drummer?
Only because I've gotten some of the software lately, and I go, oh, okay, now I get it. That's what's going on. Because the studio is really expensive, for one thing. And, it's several hundred dollars an hour, a good studio is. And the drums, there's so many variables. It's just horrible being a drummer in the studio. It really is. Because, your set might sound okay in a noisy nightclub, with a bunch of other instruments. But, boy, you get in the studio and you put a microphone on that tom-tom, and all of a sudden you hear all the buzzes and rattles and your bass drum pedal squeaking. And it's just crazy how, your set, the set that you have that you play live with, is probably not going to work in the studio, or it's going to take a lot of work to make it sound good. So you're talking about a day for just to get the drums ready to go, right? Maybe two. I think it's what happened to Damien. We took a couple of days just getting the drums, the sounds, right? So if those producers and those bands, they could save a day or two charges for setting up the drums, I understand why they do it.
Yeah, I could see that part of it too, but because a lot of times people will send me music, and the indie artist David, and they'll say listen to it, and I'll listen to it, and I'll think, man, it sounds great, it sounds perfect, everything sounds perfect. Then I'm thinking, is that what we should be doing? You know what I mean? It's like there isn't the squeaks and there isn't the human element to it. Now, I know if I was paying the bills and it was, I'm writing a check for it, and somebody would say, okay, you're going to bring a drummer in, he's going to cost you this amount of money, this is what's going to happen, or you're going to have this program and it's already paid for, so what do you want to do? If you're looking at it from an economic standpoint, you might think, hey, let's go with the program. But what do you think of that? I mean, like the future.
it depends on what kind of music it is. If it's some kind of pop stuff, then it doesn't really matter. If you're Katy Perry or somebody like that, what does it matter if there's a drummer playing on there, right? Then it doesn't really matter. But if you're an indie pop band or something, and you got to, there are a lot of. Man, there are so many good drummers around right now. It's nuts. There's a couple of guys in this town that just completely always blow my mind when I see them. I go, how they're so young, how they get that good. If it's an indie band, I would definitely rather hear a – but, you can't go in there. A lot of these guys are really young, indie bands. You go in there. And they don't have it together. They don't have it together tempo-wise and stuff. What are you going to do, right? You can't teach them. They have great songs, but they just don't have the groove, right? So I can see, you do what you got to do, right?
No, I totally agree with you. And I was real impressed when you would say, that you would you and Roy would just play together as a drummer and a bass player, because, you know, I think that is so cool. Because to me, you know, I play bass, and I played bass a long time ago, and I would always, you know, just, and my, the one of the guys in the band who, well, the drummer of the band that I was in, he taught me how to play the drums so he could play keys and saxophone in a couple songs. And he and I had never played the drums before. I didn't know what was going on. But as a bass player, he said, it's just like you're doing the same thing. You're just keeping the same thing going. Just get that. And he taught me a couple, you know, 16th beat, a couple things. And, you know, then I really got that connection with, you know, with the drummer. And I think that would be something that, you know, you look at. I wonder if I could tell. If I listen to a recording and I can tell if it's a real drummer or a program drummer. I've really never thought about it, although I've heard some that sound, like I said, that sounded so perfect that they almost had to be, but I don't know. My guess
yeah,
is
you
David
can't tell anymore. You can't tell anymore.
Yeah,
you really can't. I thought that I could until I got the software. They have this little slider that you change for the to change the feel. Like say you're going boom, bap, boom, boom, bap, boom, bap, boom, boom, bap, right? You change the slider, it goes boom, bap, boom, boom, bap, boom, bap, boom, boom, bap. I mean, it starts to swing. It's called the swing control. So if you have this really dry groove, you just move this little slider, and all of a sudden it swings. That's nuts, isn't it?
I think the robots are taking over, David. That's what's happening.
Oh, it's only just beginning, my friend.
Well, let's play
and your company makes them. No.
Probably. Oh yeah. Let's turn the page on that one. But let's play one of Damien's songs that you sent me. I'd just like to which one would you like to hear out of the ones you sent? We played Face the Crowd.
How about No More Tenderness?
Let's play that. This is my guest is David Foer, and he's currently the drummer for Bubble Puppy and was back in the day, and you can go on his website, davidfoer.com, and the schedule where you're going to be playing would be on there, David, so people, if they wanted to go.
No, but you probably have better luck with I don't update that page very often, but go on Facebook and Bubble Puppy 2012 or the official Bubble Puppy page. We'll have our schedule.
And we'll be right back.
Facebook is pretty much more. That's a even we figured out that's what we should do.
It's so easy, and it's actually pretty. It can be free, so that's always good.
And also, there is actually a bullpuppy.com too.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. And we'll be right back with David right after this song.
Sounds good.
No more tenderness. All the laughter died. Ah, how many years did I have to cry? All the love of all.
To welcome everyone back to John Talk Radio. My guest is David Fore from Bubble Puppy and Damien. And David, we didn't talk about your time with D-Day. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? We got just a few minutes left.
Sure, yeah. It seems like I have a successful band about every decade and a half, and that was one of them. Had one in the 70s with Bubble Puppy, and then in the 80s when the whole punk new wave thing came in. I was in a horrible, horrible cover band in Houston, and that so that this once again the scene in Austin looked really good to me, and so I came back here, and we just that was the beginning of the DIY do-it-yourself record scene, and we put out one of the first independent singles, and it sold 8,000 copies and got licensed by Rhino and sold about 80,000 copies, and so That was a pretty fun band too. It was two professional comedians, so that was great. But wow. Hey, could I give a shout out to my buddies in Bull Puppy?
Sure. Yeah. No doubt.
I don't want to, you know.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Through the whole interview without saying hi to my my best friend, my longest term friend ever, Rod Prince, and Mark Miller, and Greg Stegall, and Jimmy Umstead, and Lori. Thanks for the website work. But we'll get that out of the way.
Yeah, that's great. You guys got great, you know, such a history together, and I'm just so excited about, you know, how it's going right now. Because sometimes, you know, when bands get back together or they do it, it just sometimes it works and sometimes, David, it doesn't. But it seems like the chemistry is there, and you know, from listening to the YouTubes, man, it's just you can feel the excitement.
Oh, yeah, it's just, yeah, I mean, it would just drive the audience crazy, you know, and it's such a great band, I mean, it really is, it's fun because it challenges me, it really challenges me that playing that material at that level and playing it well is probably the biggest challenge musically I have right now, and it's a lot of fun, and you know, who knows where it's going to go? We thought, you know, we got back together to get inducted into the Hall of Fame in Austin, and it was so much fun. We just kept playing.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you did, and I would love to be able to hear you guys sometime if I ever get down that way, or you go on.
Definitely.
You guys get in your Volkswagen bus and head up this way. and you definitely have to do a video of that. But David, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. It's been great talking to you. It's just, you know, we always have a good time talking about the music, and you know, you lived it, and it's just so cool to talk, you know, about that. So thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, John.
And I would just like to thank everyone that's listening. And next week will be a big show because David, I have Homer Scarborough on my show next week, who was in a rockabilly band in the 1955-1957 called Sweetie Jones and the Dixie Cats.
Oh,
Homer,
my
was
God.
He was the original drummer. He was on my show about 3 months ago. They found the original singer for the band, and she's going to be on, and one of their managers going to be on. So it's like, it's just awesome.
That's crazy. So you're going back farther than Bull Puppy now.
We're going way back. And
you're going
it's
way
awesome.
Back now.
Yeah, it's great. It's just a lot of fun to talk to them, but they still have that same love, you know, for music, which is just great. So thanks so much for listening to John Talk Radio tonight, and David, have a great evening.
Thanks, John.